Welcome back to Marooned, the podcast for the class of 1990, who unfortunately can't have our 30th reunion. Sob, sob. Today's guest is Michael Frankel. Do you go by Michael or Mike?
Either one.
Either one?
Whatever will get me called to dinner.
All right, I'm going to call you Mike. Great. Is that okay? All right, Mike Frankel. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where do you live right now?
Sure. So now I live in a town called Pelham, which is a really small town in southern Westchester, on the border of the Bronx. So it's as close as you can get to New York and still have a backyard.
Very cool. Is it on the 4 or 5? Is it on like the subway or no?
No. So there's two Pelhams. There's Pelham Bay, which is part of the Bronx and is the end of the 4, 5, 6 line.
Okay.
And there's a giant golf course, and then there's Pelham Westchester, which is a little further. That's where I live.
Okay, so. Got it. I used to work in the Bronx way back in the early 90s, and I remember Pelham was like the end of the line. So.
Yep.
All right. So and now, how long have you lived there?
Lived there one 9-year-old, so 9.5 years.
Ah, okay. So you have a 9-year-old. Who else are you living with?
And my wife. So my wife, Shayna, who is class of 99, UFC. But she is prettier, younger, and smarter than me. So she also has a master's from Harvard and a PhD from Columbia. So you can tell who the idiot in the family is.
So she is the queen. That's impressive. Now, how did you meet Shayna?
She's so Shayna
significantly...
and I...
younger.
We did not meet on campus. That would not have been appropriate. although we did overlap. She was a Prosby high school student with her mom visiting campus when I was a third year law student. But her mom would have hit me with her purse if I'd tried to approach her daughter. No, we met in DC on sort of a weird blind date thing where a friend of hers brought together several single men that she knew and several single women that she knew and sort of hoped that a table at Cozy and a bunch of tea would make it all happen. And it did.
And it did. And it worked. Yeah. That is amazing. So when you met her, did you already know she was a UC grad or?
We figured it out really quickly. Yeah. Okay. But by the end of the conversation, we had figured out that we both went to UFC. I think that was one of the things that really brought us together. And luckily for me, she did the math wrong and didn't realize how big the age gap was at the time.
So she's not that smart. Just saying.
Exactly. Just yeah, exactly.
Math is hard. Math is hard. Oh, that's so cool. Shayna, I love it. Now, and you guys have been married how long?
We've been married 13 years.
Okay. I thought you were going to say 8 years. Just kidding. Not with it. 13 years. Good. Yep. And your current occupation, what are you doing in Pelham?
I run something called the Deloitte New Venture Accelerator, which is not an accelerator, and we don't do venture investing, but I am employed by Deloitte, so it's one-third accurate. It's basically an internal strategy and operations team that helps Deloitte build technology businesses.
Oh, cool. Okay. Got it. So you're kind of a new venture accelerator.
Sort of. Yeah. You know what it is?
In the literal.
Exactly. They named it without thinking about how the market uses those words. So right. It's correct English. I accelerate ventures. It's just not venture capital, and I'm not what most people think of as an accelerator.
An incubator or whatever. Exactly. That's so cool. Okay, good. All right, well, tell us where you originally came from. Did you grow up in the New York area?
No, I grew up in Boston, in a town called Brookline, which is sort of the super close suburb to Boston. I was there. Both my parents are academics. My father was an academic. He was at MIT and my mother was at BU.
Oh, wow. What sort of academics? What were there?
My father was a professor of ocean engineering and management of technology. And my mother, was a law professor. My mom is the lazy one in the family. She finally retired from full-time teaching, and she's now only an adjunct and mostly working on her writing at the age of 94. Thought that was okay, you know, not too much of a slacker.
Are they both still around, your parents?
My father passed a couple of years ago. My mom is up in up in Newton, actually, now, writing, publishing, and doing Skype conversations with her former students.
Oh my gosh, she sounds, can I just call her next and interview her? She sounds amazing.
She's absolutely amazing. My mom has led this amazing life. She fought in 48 in Israel. She got her PhD at Harvard. She was, the Wall Street Journal had an article on her a couple of years ago that said, what was the headline was, at 92, this woman is still shaking up Wall Street.
Wow. Wow. Law professor at BU.
At BU, yeah.
Very, very interesting. What's her first name?
Tamar, T-A-M-A-R. So everyone should Google her.
Google her, Tamar Frankel. Yeah, I'm totally doing that. And she was an immigrant as well?
She was, yeah. She came to, she was a lawyer in Israel. She actually drafted parts of the Constitution when Israel was formed in 48. And then she came to the United States to get her PhD at Harvard. She's already a lawyer, but so she got her SJD at Harvard and then stayed.
Wow. Wow. Impressive. Okay. All right. Back to you. Her amazing offspring.
Yeah.
Was it a big family? Did you have a lot of?
No. Yeah. I grew up an only child. I have a half sister and I have some step siblings. But yeah, I was enough trouble all on my own.
Yeah. She was busy. They both. Okay. So how did you end up? You had academics for parents, so I can kind of see how UC might be on your radar.
That's exactly how it got on
my radar.
I applied to a bunch of schools like everybody did, but my mom and dad were both incredibly enamored of Chicago, right? It's a professor's school. And so they encouraged me to take a look, and I came out for a prospective student's weekend and just had the most amazing time. And for me, it was the combination of great books, and I had like a super fun weekend with parties and cool people, and really? That was sort of, it was like nerd meets fun, which was what I aspired to be.
I agree with that. I had the same, a similar, my parents were not academics at all, but wonderful people, but U of C wasn't on our radar, but I felt the same way when I went there. I was like, oh yeah, nerds having fun, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's start over here. So you land at U of C.
Yeah.
Where did you live your freshman year?
Philby House in the Shoreland, 10th floor.
Oh, you were in the Shoreland.
I was in the Shoreland,
I was 4th floor.
Ah, okay.
House.
Yeah.
We didn't go up, though, really. We didn't go up so much.
Well, why would you? Yeah, exactly. You were close to Fred and the bus. And that was the only thing that mattered at Shoreland.
Did your room face the lake, or did it face the city?
My room faced the city.
All right.
First year, and it faced the south side the second year. But the second year, I had one of those two-bedroom apartments.
Yes.
Which was amazing. And we, our resident head, I'm sure the statute of limitations has run out, but our resident head would buy us beer and would be totally fine with beer and pretty much anything as long as you didn't leave the floor, was his theory. And so early on in our first quarter, my roommates and I threw this insane party, and it sort of spiraled out of control in a good way, where we thought we'd have like 20 or 30 people over. And we ended up having, and I know this for a reason, I'll explain in a second, we ended up having 450 people over the course of the evening. And the reason I know that is we were asking people for like $2 a head to come in and then just drink whatever you want to drink, right? That was our theory, was that'll sort of keep us. And people started bringing beer and bringing pony kegs and stuff. And when the dust settled at about 3 a.m, we were all sitting on our couch. The apartment is just littered with beer cans and food and everything. And we start pulling money out of our pockets. And we ended up with $450.
Wow.
Which was enough to buy a giant TV on which we played Pong.
God, I love it. Yes. So I think I probably was at that party. Was that
freshman? Yeah.
Freshman year or sophomore?
A sophomore year.
Sophomore year. Okay. I was definitely there because I lived on the 11th floor sophomore year. Yep. So if there was a party in the vicinity, I was at it.
You were
sure.
Probably cruising down. Yeah.
How fun. How fun. Yeah. Gosh, I can't remember that party, but it sounds like you had so much
alcohol. I think that's a sign of a good party.
Yeah. In college, for sure. Now, not so much. That's amazing. So Shoreland, yay. Yeah. Fellow Shoreland.
And our motto first year, and we had t-shirts printed up with this, was Philby House, demented and sad, but social.
I totally remember that. Who was your roommate? Were you friends with him?
So I haven't stayed in touch with my freshman roommate. David Adams and Mike Suing were my sophomore year roommates.
Okay. Yeah. Totally remember those guys. Wow. Sounds like you had a fun freshman and sophomore. Did you stay there all 4 years? Or
I didn't. No. After that, I weaseled my way into graduate student housing. To save money because I was entering. I talked my way into getting into the MA program, or I was applying to the MA in International Relations program. And I went to graduate student housing, and I told them I was going into the MA program, and I just didn't mention the fact that I was still in an undergrad. And they were like, okay, here, fill out this form. And so I for my last 2 years, I had a basement apartment in the building just across the street from north of Pierce and to the left of the seminary. There's this little apartment building. It's like a generic apartment building, graduate student housing. And there was a basement apartment, like a studio, for $340. And that was my apartment for my last 2 years.
Oh, wow. That's very interesting. So no roommates? You lived alone?
No roommates. Yep. I lived alone.
Great location. And where did you eat? Did you go over to Pierce or something?
Or? I cooked or I know I didn't do the food. I didn't do the meal program my second 2 years. My first 2 years, I ate at Pierce like everybody from Shoreland. Trauma of having to get on a bus to have a meal so tore me up that I just started cooking. So I went to Maury's.
Yeah. Salonika.
Yeah, exactly.
That place is great. Okay. Very interesting. So you were a poli sci major.
That's right. Yeah.
So did you graduate with an MA?
I got the poli sci bachelor's degree and the master's in international relations.
At the same time?
Yep.
In 4 years?
Yep.
Did you study abroad then? Did you go overseas?
No. I spent time overseas. Growing up, I spent almost every summer living overseas. So it wasn't as much of a pull for me. My father is an MIT professor, and he spent his summers consulting, basically in any country that was building a port system in the 1970s. So I spent my summers in Malaysia, in Singapore, in Korea, in Israel, in Spain, in Bangladesh. So I had less of a urge. I did spend one summer, the summer between second and third year, I spent in Singapore working for a shipping company as my summer internship. I didn't do a study abroad.
Okay. You didn't need it. Sounds like you didn't need it. You had that covered.
Yeah. It was a little less like high priority because I felt like I'd lived in a lot of places.
Yeah. Wow. So where would you study? If you were in these grad programs, were you taking the same classes, or were you taking all graduate level classes by your third year?
I'd say it was probably 70% grad classes or 60%, and the rest was just filling out my requirements. So I spent a lot of time in PIC because all the grad poli sci courses were in PIC. So I was in PIC a lot of the time, and then random other places.
Whenever you could. And how did it impact your social life or your extracurriculars that you did? And what did you do?
Right. So I did theater.
Ooh.
And I did Model UN. So we were our class were the founders of Chicago Model UN, which continues strong to this day, both as a team that competes and as a high school Model UN competition that gets run by Chicago. So that was a lot of my time, and university theater, especially, or Blackfriars, actually, especially my first year. And then after that, I mostly just hung out, and I hung out with a lot of the poli sci grad students. And I, you know, I was cranking to get both degrees done because I wanted to get them done in 4 years.
Yeah. So mature. You're so mature.
mature, just lazy. I went, you know, like get it done, pull off the Band-Aid.
You don't sound lazy. Okay, so you were in Blackfriars, what productions were you in? Do you have a story?
Yeah, I definitely have a story. The first production I did was Dracula. So it was the fall of our freshman year. And I was an actor, as was our classmate Chris Vogt and Jackie Jacobson.
And John McGinn.
McGinn, that's right. Oh my God, I totally forgot about that. Oh my God, it was so much fun because it was such a cool group of people. But the one big challenge was that our director, Ralph, and I'm forgetting his last name, but he was two or three years ahead of us, took it deadly seriously. He wrote the script himself. He had a deep story. And I don't think he understood that it didn't necessarily come off as serious. It sort of came off as campy. And the moment that I still remember, so I was Dr. Sayward. So I was the doctor. And oh my God, I'm forgetting his name now. Dracula's like right hand.
I don't remember either, but
you know
I
know what I'm talking about. Yeah. But anyway, I'm the doctor, and he's in an insane asylum, and I'm his doctor, and Renfield. The storyline was that Renfield had a pet mouse, and I was like imposing discipline, and I was like, Renfield, you know, you can't have a pet mouse. You have to give it to me. And you know, our director was like, this is so serious. This is like his last friend, and you are taking the friend from him, and you think you're doing the right thing. And like, there was all this subtext, and so we were all really serious about it, or supposed to be really serious. But what the audience saw was me yelling at Renfield, going, Renfield, give it to me. Renfield, give it to me. And then Renfield had a blood pack, which is, if you don't know, it's like liquid blood in a plastic bag. And the director insisted that the blood pack be about the size of my fist. And Renfield, again, in an emotional moment where he would rather kill the animal than allow it to be taken from him, bites into the mouse, right? Again, it's supposed to be so emotional. But what the audience saw was Renfield, give it to me. Renfield, give it to me. And then I get spattered with, I don't know, a cup and a half of blood.
A ton of blood, yeah.
And the audience just laughed their heads off. And it became worse on Halloween night when we did the play. And now the audience is drunk. And they get, you know, Renfield, give it to me. Blah. It was just, there was that one. And the really, like, sexualized one was Chris Vogt straddling Jackie Jacobson. Jackie Jacobson is lying like in a gown on a coffin. Chris is standing over her, like straddling her. And the line I will never forget is, we will mix our blood with the blood of nature. At which point he squeezes blood and it just drips all over Jackie Jacobson in a sort of a flash dance kind of moment. Which again was supposed to be so serious, and the audience went just nuts for it. And I'd say by the like fourth performance, the director was befuddled by why this was happening, but the rest of us were like, "All right,
you're camping it up."
But so we I'm still in Full touch confession. With us, all four of them. Yeah,
I was there. I was at the opening night of Dracula, because John McGinn was the first friend I made at University of Chicago. And we're still good friends. He's the godfather to my children. But he walked. So I went with Nikki Nichols, who lived next door to me. And we were good friends with John. And we all lived in Bishop House. And we walk in. And I don't think John, I'm not sure, but I don't think John had been in theater in high school. Maybe he had. But I don't think he was really, like, he was a newcomer to this whole scene. And Nikki and I, maybe we'd had a couple drinks before we showed up. I'm not sure. But we sit down, and the minute he walked up, first of all, it was campy. So we were already kind of giggling. And I don't know what role he had, but he walked on stage, and we both, and the whole place was super quiet, and Nikki and I exploded in laughter just by the sight of John. And the whole thing, too, had been going a little that direction anyway. So, but we just exploded, and John broke character. And he looked right at us and was like, what are you doing? Like, gave us this dirty look, and then went back to the character and carried on. It was so funny. And it's one of those vivid memories. So Dracula, I wish video.
I would play that over and over again.
I'd watch it every night.
Yeah.
What a great story. Did you do other productions as well? Or?
I did, but I think I was so traumatized by Dracula. I did more like lighting and sound and stuff like that. But I hung out on the third floor of Reynolds Club for like a big chunk of first year. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Very cool. What a great way to get involved, you know, as a freshman.
Well, and made those really close friends, like John and Chris and Jackie and I, like, really stayed in touch through the rest of college and after college.
Wow. Love it. I hope they all come. You guys could reenact it. That would be so funny.
I would do my part. I think Vogt would be the one who'd be most traumatized by doing that, because he just like he left theater after that. That was, he did one play and he was, I'm not going to do it again, because people would like see him around campus and be like, Dracula. He's 6'6".
Yeah.
So he was like very recognizable.
Very funny. Okay. What else did you do? Did you ever do sleep out for classes?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I loved sleep out. The irony is I did sleep out. I didn't need to do sleep out. Yeah, no, it was totally just for fun. And it was Mike Suing and I, and I remember we went to Kimbark Liquors. And again, the statute of limitations is up on this. And two 18-year-olds went into Kimbark Liquors. And and we were like, we don't have that much money. What can we get? And the guy was like, well, I could give you the box of beer. And we're like, what's the box of beer? And the box of beer was basically all the like extras and like random beers he had in the back that didn't match a six pack. So
the sampler.
It was like a Dutch dark beer and Bud and like whatever he had. It was a big box of beer. And so we're like, yeah, great. $10 for a box of beer.
We took
our box of beer onto the quad and it was so much fun. I still remember we're very excited as we, I think that year, the line of bottles reached the reg, which was the big goal, right? I don't know if you remember this. The goal was to get a line of bottles and cans to go from Hutch to the reg.
Oh my God.
Like they went right through the quad. And my other big memory from that was some guy had run an extension cord from Rosenwald and was studying in his sleeping bag. And I was thinking, you and I have a totally different approach to this event.
Totally. I remember water guns and water gun fights and things like that, and just running around being maniacs. Yeah. And then I think, I'm not even sure I slept out and registered. I think I went and partied and then went back to my dorm and slept. As an English major, really none of my classes were very sought after, except Shakespeare, which I think eventually I did have to sleep out for that. But those are fun. No one does that anymore.
No. And that's one of those things that, like, some of the evolution of the school, I think, is a good idea. You know, I think, having Starbucks on campus is great.
Having
food and stuff like that. But I feel like there has to be a way to have things like sleep out without it being, I understand you don't want it to be a liability, but that was just such a, I tell people stories about that. It's like such a vivid memory. It's like Kuvia-Sunark, right? It's this thing that, you know, 30 years later, I vividly recall.
Right. And you really had to, invest an entire night. You know, you really had to show up early and set up your area and, I was at Duke University with my son, who's a senior, and he's not going there, by the way. But there were all these kids sleeping out in tents for a basketball game. So that's what they do, because there's it's a small stadium or a small field house, and they have the limited number of seats. So they sleep out, and they were having so much fun. And Duke allows this to continue. Like, they've created an area for the kids to camp in too, so it's pretty cool. Not to talk about, but whatever. So did you go to grad school afterwards? Did you get a PhD?
I did not get a PhD. That's my retirement plan. I got a JD and an MBA.
Underachiever. All from where?
All from UC. I bleed maroon.
As I
tell people, I don't dress well enough to go to other schools, so I just keep on going back to Chicago.
So I was going to ask you, do you use your major? But obviously, you must use those, right?
I use the poli-sci degree. Like one of the things I tell people is John Mearsheimer taught me how to write. And to this day, I've written 3 books and a bunch of articles, and I write for my job. And I use the approach that Mearsheimer taught me how to write.
Wow. You know, that UFC taught me how to write as well. Little Red Schoolhouse. I don't know if you took that. Yeah.
I didn't, but
it was a good class. Yeah. I actually use it now. I teach and I use the principles of that with all the kids that I work with. And they're like, this is so much easier. They love it. So what exactly are you doing now? Tell us about your job at Deloitte.
It's a really funky job. I never thought I would end up at a professional services firm, but it's really unique, and I'm sort of having a blast. I had a crazy path. Like I had a random like a pinball machine path. So I was a lawyer at Skadden, then I was a banker at Merrill, then I went and did mergers and acquisitions at a number of different tech companies, and strategy. And then I went to a couple of little tech companies and I was the CFO, COO. And then I got a call about this job at Deloitte. And I was like, well, I'm not a consultant. Why would I go to Deloitte? And then they explained it to me. And it's really cool. It's basically, Deloitte's the largest professional services firm in the world. So we sell time and materials. We sell, here are our smart people, and our smart people will do stuff for you and you pay us based on the number of hours. And what we've discovered is that an increasing number of our clients' problems are not solved by just people, and they're not solved by just technology. They're solved by deeply integrating humans and technology. So it's not the iPhone, right? I can give you the iPhone, you're happy, you don't need any help with your iPhone. Or, you know, there are certain, your dentist is a human being doing stuff for you, and you wouldn't want a piece of technology doing your dental work. But there are a lot of problems that are best solved for our clients by combining tech and humans. And the firm started to build those businesses and discovered they're really different than a professional services business in a variety of different ways. How you staff them, how you run them, the economics of them, all that kind of stuff. And so my team was formed to help the firm be successful building those businesses. So it's really cool because I do a combination of strategy work where I help us figure out where do we want to build one of those businesses and invest a lot of money in technology. And then I do operational work to help those businesses be successful inside a professional services firm. Because you have to do everything differently. This is a one-to-one business. We ask you exactly what your problem is and we solve it custom for you. And technology is a one-to-many business. We build a piece of technology that maybe can configure a little bit, but we basically sell the same thing to everyone. And that is so different. And so if you're a professional services firm building technology businesses, you need to do almost everything differently because it's just a different model. And by the way, it works in the other direction. If you're a technology business trying to build professional services, you need to understand that now you're in the one-to-one world. You can't just say, well, this is the way we do it. So it creates a bunch of really interesting business problems around finance and marketing and sales and product management and brand. And so my team's job is to help the firm sort those things out because these kind of businesses are a big part of the future of the firm. So we're sort of like the rebel force inside of a massive organization. The US firm has 110,000 people.
Your customers are Deloitte people, right? They're internal? Okay.
That's right. Yeah, I would say, my customers are the people who run the biggest businesses in the firm, and my job is to help them build new businesses. So a good example would be, we have a cyber business. We are one of the largest, if not actually the largest cyber professional service. So if you need help with your cyber defense, you call us. I am working very closely with the leader of that practice to build technology businesses. So now we actually have one where we can either advise you on cyber if that's what you want, and that's a consulting business, or we can run your cyber defense for you. We can run your threat detection for you because we have a combination of people and a whole technology stack to do that. So we're starting to, you can sort of see that natural evolution, which is you come to us for advice, and for some things you go, you know what, just do it for me.
Right.
I don't want to do that. That's not my core skill set. I, you know,
yeah.
make cheese. I, you know, build, make bicycles. And I don't want to deal with cyber defense. You just be my cyber defense. So, you know, we're building businesses like that.
It sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
It is. What's great about it, if you think about sort of the connection back to U of C, is it's really complicated problems. They're very rare in the world. Most people don't have to deal with this because there aren't many professional services firms building these things. And they're incredibly diverse because we don't play in one industry. We play in every industry by definition, right? So I spend my day dealing with cyber and life sciences, healthcare, and marketing, consumer packaged goods, and technology, infrastructure technology, and cloud, and tax. So the diversity of the role is one of the things that attracted me to it, which, you know, and I'm not just doing this to be self-serving, ties back to why I loved U of C, because I loved being able to poke my nose into lots of different stuff and try different things and sort of not be constrained. So that, you know, 30 years later, that sort of brought me to this job.
Interesting. It's sort of arising as I start talking to more and more people. That's kind of a common theme that people have bounced around. And maybe that's just because we're 50, 52, whatever. But people have bounced around and tried different things. And, you know, well, we've all kind of done that. Maybe that was nurtured in us at an early stage.
I think it was. I think that sort of intellectual curiosity and not being told what to do was. Like, one of the ways I describe Chicago, and I think it's probably still true, my niece is class of 2010, and so I have a slightly closer view of it, but I think it's still true, is it was a very DIY experience, which was either a good thing or a bad thing, right? Like, the you know, social life and activities was very DIY. There wasn't a single track. You had to figure out who you were and what you liked to do. And the same thing was true for the academic experience. I at least for me, I still remember I went to Mearsheimer at the end of my second year. And I was like, I've taken all your undergrad courses. And I've taken all of Lipson's undergrad courses. And this is what I want to study. So can I join your... you know, he had a seminar in the fall, and he was like, well, it's a PhD seminar and everybody else in it is working on their dissertation, so you'd have to have something you're working on. And I'm like, well, I think I'm going to have my bachelor's thesis framed out by there. Could I do that? He's like, yeah, sure. So I wrote my bachelor's thesis in large part in a seminar that was a PhD seminar. So everyone else was working on sections of their dissertation and I was working on my bachelor's thesis. Yeah. But it's, you know, I think at a lot of other schools, you couldn't do that. It was, you know, you were much less constrained. And I think that's sort of my whole career has been like that. Oh, that's interesting. I'm sure I can figure that out. Why don't I go try that?
Well, it sounds like you have fun at your job. Are you able to work from home? Zoom.
Yeah. Ironically, my work has not changed at all. In fact, my biggest challenge is I've had to push off on work to try to help my wife with homeschooling. My team was already totally virtual, so we have 23 people on the team in 10 different cities. So I was already working from home 3 days a week. So it's had almost the biggest change is that I've now got the brand permission in this environment to grow a really unattractive beard, which I couldn't do before. But I call it hobo chic.
My husband works from home 100%, and the hardest thing for him is having us here.
Yeah.
Can you guys stop talking? Be quiet. So.
Oh yeah, you have to find your spaces and My one embarrassing story is everybody else on Zoom has those automatic virtual backgrounds that Zoom provides, but you know, I happen to have one of the few laptops, my work laptop, that has a graphics chip that doesn't allow that to work.
I felt
very shameful about the fact that I didn't have virtual backgrounds. And so in a move that is either smart or pathetic, depending on how you look at it, I ordered these two stands and a bright green St. Patrick's Day tablecloth. And I made my own green screen behind me in my home office.
Pathetic. I would say pathetic.
Thank you. Yeah. But now I get the cool pictures behind me. Like, yeah, everybody.
That is good. I like that. You know, the University of Chicago has a backgrounds package. Have you seen that?
not only have I seen it, that's my main background, is the University of Chicago overhead shot of campus.
Yes, great. Yeah. I've seen several people with that. I love it.
Yeah.
Are you able to take vacations with all this hard work you're doing?
I am. So I took my last, what I call normal vacation, was in August when I went to Iceland, which was amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know about you. It was one of my favorite vacations.
Yeah, we did the stopover. We were only there 2 days, but we did do the
Blue Lagoon.
We did the Blue Lagoon. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Which was
yeah.
crowded. It was like being in a Vegas hotel pool. It's like, because everyone's drinking.
Right.
You know, there's like plastic cups floating by, but it was still incredible. It was still amazing.
Yeah.
So
we
Eight days. What did you do? Did you?
Oh, it was incredible. The only bad side of it was I had the bright idea, which my wife will never let me forget, to rent a camper van for 4 of those 8 days. And there was a windstorm. And so we got trapped in one town because it was too high wind to drive the camper van.
Oh,
so that was the one downside. But other than that, no, it was amazing. We saw the original geyser. We did this so incredibly cool thing. We went to a glacier, and they drive you up a glacier in this giant machine that's a converted missile launcher. It's basically turned into a bus, but with 8-foot-tall wheels. And you go to the top of the glacier, and they've drilled a hole, creating a tunnel that goes like 200 feet down into the glacier.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
You put on crampons and you go down into the heart of the glacier. That was amazing.
Terrifying. Did your daughter do it as well?
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
And you went 100 feet into this inside a glacier.
Yeah. I mean, you. It's like a walk. You're just walking. Oh. You just have to be careful not to slip.
You're not like rappelling down.
No. It's they put
like
little things on your. Yeah. No. It's a 200-foot long tunnel, but it's 200 feet like that. So
slow.
You're just slowly walking down.
Okay. I'm picturing like something completely different. Water slide or something.
Tying down my 8-year-old and going, off you go.
And so where did you stay besides the camper? Were you in Reykjavik or?
We were in Reykjavik. So we stayed 4 nights in the camper and 4 nights in Reykjavik in an Airbnb, which was fantastic.
Did you drink the fish oil for breakfast? The cosmic
oil?
We did. They gave you They gave us shots.
Really?
Cod liver oil. Yeah. We all drank it.
Ooh. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
It's like drinking, I would say, canola oil or something. It wasn't super gross, but we tried it. I was waiting for my hair and skin to start glowing, but that didn't happen.
Our food experience there was amazing. Everything we ate was like the best we'd ever, pastry, ice cream. It was incredible.
And the water.
Yeah.
The water. I'm not a bottled water person, but their bottled water was insane. We smelled
it. It tastes different. Yeah.
Yeah. Even in the airport, I remember the fast food in the airport, that seafood place in the middle. Yeah, it was really good. So now what are you doing? You're now, I know you've taken a week off work, right? You're on a mini break.
We're doing the COVID vacation, which is so my daughter's school didn't have any winter break. So we haven't had a break since December. So we were all going a little nutty. Uh-huh. And we got hunkered down early because our town abuts New Rochelle. So we basically locked down for 2 months.
Yeah.
And my daughter has a school vacation this week. And I was like, how do I turn this into a vacation? And my daughter loves to swim. Like she'll spend 5 hours a day in a pool if she's allowed. So I searched Airbnb and I found a house about an hour and a half north of us in the Hudson Valley on about 20 acres of land, totally isolated, with an indoor pool and a hot tub and a foosball table and a sauna. And so, we're here for a week and we spend our days hiking and riding bikes and playing in the pool. And
wow. Sounds like Iceland. super fun. And what are you reading or watching?
So I'm it's interesting. I think that there's like an, at least right now for me, a need for nostalgia. So I'm doing a lot of throwbacks. So we're watching, my wife and I are watching The Sopranos, which she has never seen and I hadn't seen in whatever, 15 years. So almost all the way through that.
And how does it hold up?
Oh, it holds up really well. Okay. It really, really well. Yeah, it's paced, which I like, right? So it's not as fast moving as some shows, but I find it really good. So I loved it. And you know, the senility is kicking in, so I didn't remember a lot of it. So it was almost like watching the same thing again.
Yeah, over again. Yeah.
But and then I'm reading this book that I read right after college, actually, which I love and which is very calming to me, called Blue Highways, which was written it came out in like 82. And it's a guy who, he's actually an English professor who lost his job, and he decided to build like a little camper van and travel around the country and only travel on blue highways. And blue highways were the non-interstates. So the ones that actually still went through the little towns and places. And he just wrote about his trip. And it's, you know, there's almost zero drama, right? It's like the opposite of The Sopranos. But I found it incredibly comforting and relaxing to just hear these stories about little towns and communities. And so I've gone back to that, and it's like 400 pages, and I've gone back to that, and I'm just reading it again.
Fantastic. Blue Highways, I'll check it out. Do you know who's the author?
William Least Moon.
Okay. Got it. Writing that down.
It's great. It's like yoga in book form, or meditation in book form. It's very, like, interesting, and you get caught up in the characters, but it's very relaxing.
I reread Pride and Prejudice about a month ago, which is the same thing, like slow, you know, just the pacing is so slow but so beautiful. The text is so amazing. Another nostalgic film that I just rewatched and got a totally different view of was oh my god, what's it called? The one about the Little 500 down at Indiana University. Now I have to edit all this out. Shoot. What is
it? Now everyone has to go look for it.
Right,
figure out what you're talking about.
Breaking Away.
Ugh. Oh, yeah.
Breaking Away is also a very beautiful, peaceful film, which I thought was about a coming of age story when I was young. It's really about parenting. So watch it again.
That's great.
Ned Beatty is amazing in it. And it's really about being a parent. Of kids who are a little bit lost, or a kid who's lost. So I hear you on that. Did you watch The Tiger King? Be honest.
Not yet. I'm not sure if there's enough soap to wash my brain after watching
it. So bad. It was fascinating the first couple episodes, and then you have to see what happens. It's kind of like that. Yeah, it's total crap. So
I have a bigger problem, which is I read all of the Game of Thrones books. And I didn't I didn't watch the series because I kept waiting for the last book to come out, and I hadn't written the last book. So I'm finally gonna watch the series, and I'm very excited about it because
you're gonna be one of those guys that's like, well, wait a minute, what happened to so and so? Because it diverges early.
Right.
I read three of the Game of Thrones, three of those books. Mm-hmm. Because I watched the first season of Game of Thrones and thought, oh, I have to read these books. Yeah. And then quickly realized there was a huge gap. But it's such a great series. You're going to love it.
I'm very excited. But I'm not allowed to watch it yet because now that I've addicted my wife to Sopranos, she has to see the end.
So yeah.
We have to finish that and then we'll get on.
For sure. Michael, it's been so great talking to you.
Very cool. Thank you so much, by the way, for doing this. I really appreciate that you're doing this.
It's
so psyched to see the other ones.
It's so fun. I posted one today, and I'm going to post one on like Wednesday, and then I'll put you up in a little bit too. So, and I've got three or four more lined up. So, but I do need more volunteers if anyone wants to come forward.
I'll light some up. You've inspired me. All of the Dracula cast, I'm going to get them all.
Oh, for sure. In fact, we should do one that's just about Dracula, just about that prediction. That'd be so funny. Have a great vacation.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of the Sopranos.
Yeah, you too. You stay well, you know, keep your husband and kids at bay?
I will. They're being very quiet, which is always concerning. Which
means I was going to say, too quiet. Mass.
Yeah, exactly. Take care. And I loved it. It was great to talk to you.
It was great to talk to you. And we will, next year, we will see each other in person.
For sure we will.